Hi everyone, my name is Abhi and I'm here with my co-host Perdis, and welcome back to Med Made Real. This is a podcast that highlights the life-changing aspects of medical treatments and procedures while giving people with lived experience a platform to share their stories.
We are very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Lavier Curran, who is a PGY1 that I met on my internal medicine rotation and is here to talk about his experiences in internal medicine and his journey towards family medicine. So thank you so much for being here today. We're really excited to talk to you.
Of course, guys. Thanks for having me.
I think something a lot of people might not No, and actually something I only realized while on internal medicine was that there's so many procedures involved in the field. Like, I think when you think about internal medicine, you see it more as like a medical geared field, at least from like a medical student perspective. So I found that really interesting to see. Can you name some of the procedures that you've seen during your time in residency or that you've heard about?
Yeah, of course. I think the procedures are one of the things that does make internal medicine great, because it is, you often do have like very complex patients that you have to manage medically, but you do get that balance of being able to do some procedures as well. I think the three most common procedures that I've seen during my time on internal medicine would be thoracentesis, paracentesis, and then joint straining and things like that. So I guess just to go through some of those. So thoracentesis is basically draining fluid from the pleural space in the chest cavity. So the pleural space is basically a little area that's between the outer lining of the lung and the inner lining of the chest wall. And fluid can accumulate in that space. And as you can expect, it can kind of compress the lung sometimes and make things difficult for patients to breathe and that sort of thing. So it's important to get the fluid out if that's causing symptoms for the patient. There's a number of causes that can cause things like a fluid accumulation in the pleural space. Some of the things that we worry about are infections. Sometimes it can be caused by malignancy or cancer. And then other times it can just be caused by volume overload. So just too much fluid in the body overall that kind of accumulates in the lungs. Whenever we're draining this fluid, there's kind of two indications for it. So there's both diagnostic as well as therapeutic indications. So whenever there's a diagnostic indication, it means we're trying to get a fluid sample so we can test it and see what's kind of causing the underlying issue that's causing this fluid accumulation. More often there's a diagnostic indication if it's just one-sided. So this fluid can accumulate on both sides of the lung sometimes, but if it's on one side, that's more indicative of, or can be more indicative of a more concerning, etiology of the fluid accumulating. So things like cancer or an infection. So that would be for thoracentesis. In terms of paracentesis, so it's very similar. It's whenever you have fluid accumulation in the peritoneum, which is a cavity in the abdomen, and it's sort of the area that all the organs of the abdomen sit in. So the fluid accumulates outside of these organs, but in the cavity there. And again, this can cause patients significant discomfort. Obviously, having a ton of fluid in there, you're compressing all the organs in the abdomen. You're going to feel really bloated. It's not a nice feeling overall for patients. Again, this can be done for either therapeutic reasons or diagnostic reasons. Whenever we're doing it for therapeutic reasons, it's just to get the kind of the fluid out of there. If there's a large volume, I've seen like as much as like 5 liters be drained out of somebody's abdomen before. It really does take like a load off of all the organs in there and helps the patient feel a lot less bloated, a lot less heavy, that sort of thing. Now, whenever we're doing a diagnostic paracentesis, so we're looking for a couple different things. Sometimes when patients have an accumulation of fluid in the abdomen, they can get an infection called spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, which is basically whenever the fluid gets infected with bacteria. And patients that have this can decompensate super quickly. It's a super scary thing to have. So we can get a small sample of the fluid and test it. And based on the test results, it kind of guides us on if we need to start urgent antibiotics or not. And then otherwise, I guess in terms of the causes of peritoneal fluid accumulation or ascites, there's a few different common ones. So we can have things like heart failure or decompensated liver failure that can cause fluid to accumulate. And basically the pathophys behind that is really just there's a backup of pressure because blood isn't flowing through the heart or through the liver vasculature as efficiently as it should be. And that kind of causes some fluid to come out of the vessels and accumulate in the abdomen. You can kind of have like oncotic pressure causes, so things like nephrotic syndrome, where you're losing all the protein of the blood, and this just causes a imbalance of the actual, I guess, like components of the blood that causes the fluid to kind of again extravate out of the vessels into the abdomen. And then another more worrying one would be sort of a malignancy in the peritoneum. So that can kind of just cause creation of fluid from the malignancy, and that settles in the abdomen, causing the discomfort and all that sort of stuff. So whenever we're doing the diagnostic paracentesis, we can test the fluid to look for any sort of cells that would be indicative of malignancy, and then go from there and kind of figure out what the underlying etiology is causing that. Now, the approach to both thoracentesis and paracentesis is kind of similar. So basically, how we go about that is we want to first we get an ultrasound, and that kind of helps us guide, so we can kind of see what's underlying where we're gonna go entry, where we're gonna enter to drain this fluid. Back in the day, we didn't have that technology, so a lot of the time people were going in blind, and that caused a lot of complications because you couldn't really see if you were gonna poke something underneath the skin where you were going in. If you're going in for a thoracentesis in the chest wall, obviously the biggest concern is poking the lung. So we're going in with a needle to drain this fluid. And if you go too far, you poke the lung, you can create a hole in the lung, and that's going to cause a pneumothorax or a hemothorax, hydrothorax, basically collapsing the lung or an accumulation of fluid in the lung, which is not ideal for sure. So same thing in the abdomen. Whenever we're doing a paracentesis, we want to get an ultrasound first, make sure that there's no any organs or underlying bowel or anything like that we're going to poke. Obviously, if we go in with a needle and poke the bowel, we're going to have feces leaking into the peritoneum, which is the last thing that we want. That's can cause severe infections with all the bacteria that's in the gut and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And also don't want to poke any other organs that are in the peritoneal space as well. Mm-hmm. So first thing we do, use ultrasound to kind of image what's going on underneath the skin in the chest or the abdomen. After that, we get a bit of local anesthetic. So we kind of numb the skin, and we keep numbing as we go in with the needle to kind of numb all the tissue that we're going to be going across as we're going in with the needle to drain this fluid. So typically how we do it is we'll inject a little bit of the anesthetic, and then we'll proceed with the needle slowly, injecting more and more anesthetic. And as we're going in, we're drawing back on the needle to see whenever we enter the space that has the fluid. Because whenever we're in the skin, there'll kind of be resistance on the syringe that we're drawing back. And then once you feel that resistance kind of release, and you usually see a bit of fluid going into the syringe at that point, you know you're in the right space. And then based on that, you just attach a syringe to the needle, depending on whether you're doing a therapeutic or diagnostic paracentesis or thora. Typically with the diagnostic thoracentesis or paracentesis, we need a smaller sample of fluid, so it's just a smaller syringe. Whereas for the therapeutic ones, we're going to be taking a lot more fluid out, so we can connect to sort of drainage bottles that have negative pressure that will drain the fluid and that sort of thing.
So just to follow up on the difference in like the diagnostic versus therapeutic procedures, is there like a difference in the recovery periods for both of these procedures? Because when we're doing diagnostic versus therapeutic, are we looking at any like risk factors that could possibly create a more difficult recovery period? Or how would we, what would that look like essentially after these procedures are done?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So I guess in terms of recovery and complications, so with thoracentesis, like if you're taking off a larger volume of fluid, the patient's going to feel it more. And oftentimes patients do have a bit of pain after this, just because their kind of lung was compressed. It's used to being in that state. There's a lot of atelectasis or like collapsed lung there. And then whenever you suddenly take all this fluid off, they're going to really notice that there's it's expanded and they feel a bit of discomfort. In terms of recovery time, usually for both, if there's no complications, it's kind of the same with diagnostic or therapeutic. Mm-hmm. It's really just whenever you're finishing the procedure, you want to make sure that the incision site that you went in is completely occluded, so there's no air going into the space and causing a collapsed lung or a pneumothorax. But yeah, overall, the recovery time is usually pretty much the same between the diagnostic and therapeutic indications that I've seen.
Right. And like, how long does it take to kind of get good at performing this procedure? Do you find like PGY1s are typically are in there performing this procedure by themselves, or do you feel like it takes some time to kind of build up that experience, I guess, and then eventually you find that later on in your residency you can like perform these procedures?
Yeah, definitely, good question. So myself, I think I've done like 3 or 4 paracentesis, and I've done 1 thoracentesis so far. And I definitely do not feel comfortable doing them on my own. I like having somebody nearby. Even like with the paracentesis, I'm more comfortable with now. And like usually I don't need any like feedback or like very minimal feedback while I'm doing it. But the thing with like a lot of procedures and a lot of medicine is that things are easy whenever they're easy, but like things can hit the fan, and whenever they do, you want somebody nearby to be able to guide you and really make sure that nothing, like the patient doesn't decompensate. You have that backup there. So I think that like as you proceed through your training, a lot of people do get more comfortable doing it on their own. And whenever I get supervision, it's often from a PGY2 or a PGY3, like second or third year residents who just have a bit more experience than I do with this. But I think it's always good to have a bit of backup, especially if you're not 100% confident in what you're doing.
I actually got to see Dr. Lavie Curran do a paracentesis on my internal medicine rotation, and I think he's being very humble. He made it look very easy. So I guess kind of shifting gears, you touched a little bit about how on internal medicine you're seeing very complex comorbid patients. And so something else that I noticed on my rotation with you was that goals of care discussions are like very apparent in internal medicine. I think of course, it's important in every field, but I found that on my rotation in internal medicine, like that was something that was touched on pretty much with every patient almost as soon as they were admitted. And it was something that was discussed very thoroughly with each patient. So I was wondering like how you navigate these difficult kinds of conversations with patients. It's not easy talking about what their goals of care are and like talking about prognosis and treatment options. So how did you kind of navigate these conversations as an incoming resident in your first year?
Yeah, for sure. The goals of cares discussion is something that's it's very tricky, and it's something I'm still working on. I think even like very experienced staff physicians, they are still continuing to improve their approach to goals of care discussions. But obviously very important, like you said. I guess it's important to keep in mind that that with the goals of care discussion, it's really a shared decision making that you're doing. I guess back in the day, there was more of a paternalistic approach to medicine, where the doctor felt that they were meant to just kind of make the objective best decision. And then later on, there was kind of a transition to patients making their own decisions. But patients really they need to be able to make informed decisions, and because they don't have that medical expertise, it's important for us to kind of get our perspective out there too, to kind of really lay out the different options and the different outcomes and that sort of thing for the patients. When it comes to goals of care, I guess my approach is really seeing what the patient's big picture goals are. Oftentimes it's easy to kind of get tunnel vision and really just make an approach of like, do you want category 2 or category 3, or like for this next upcoming intervention, like what do you want? But it's important to take a step back and look at what the patient's overall goals are. So are they going to be happy if they're not as independent as they were before? Is their actual goal to like to go home, be able to ambulate independently, do all the things that they were doing before? Or is their goal just to be alive? They're happy to be bound to bed as long as they can watch TV and do their thing like that. So I think it's good to get a baseline of what their expectations are, what's important to them and that sort of thing. And then after that, kind of discuss what their understanding of their current ongoing medical care is, what their conditions that they have, and what a realistic prognosis is of those things. I think it gets a bit trickier whenever you have patients, which you often do in internal medicine on the wards, that don't have capacity or lack the ability to really make their own goals of care or goals of care decisions, and you're making these decisions through either their SDM or their POA, and that does complicate things a little bit. When I'm approaching those kind of goals of care discussions, I think it's really important to ensure that the POA is aware that their role in this is advising us on what the patient's goals would be if they were competent or did have that ability to make that decision. It's not what the POA thinks is best. It's what they think that the patient would have wanted if they were able to make these decisions. I had a very complex goals of care discussion this week. We were kind of going back and forth on what the family thought that would be best for the patients. And I kind of asked, has the patient ever expressed what they would want? And the family mentioned that a week prior, whenever the patient was more confident, they kind of had outlined exactly what they would want, and that they wouldn't want resuscitation, that they would value their independence. And that really helped us come to a decision, because it didn't look like their prognosis was great. And then helped us come to the decision that it would be kind of important to transition to more comfort measures, because that was what the patient's previously expressed wishes were.
Just to kind of bounce off of what you said, has there ever been a situation where, like the power attorney or the SDM did not particularly know what the patient, either in goals of care discussions or end of life care, really wanted? And if so, like how did you kind of navigate situations like that? Or even if you heard seeing colleagues navigate those discussions, like how would you essentially know at that point? Because I feel like there's a lot of bias that's going to be involved from the POA or the SDM at that point to really make the decision for the patient. Have you ever like been in situations like that or heard of situations like that?
Yeah, for sure. That's common enough because if somebody like decompensates quickly, like it's not something you talk about commonly. Like I've never had a goals of care discussion, or like my parents have never told me what their goals of care are because like they're healthy right now. But if somebody kind of has an unexpected illness and they decompensate quickly, oftentimes their goals of care haven't been discussed with their family members. And that does add a complexity to these discussions. I guess the approach to that is the POA or the family members that are around, they often know the patient best, and they just have to make give their best idea of what the patient would have wanted. So oftentimes they have an idea if a patient would have valued independence and that sort of thing. And they're really the ones that are best able to advise us on what their goals would be and that sort of thing. So it is a little more complex and tricky, but you just have to trust the family and the individuals that are close to the patient to advise us on that.
And more so to kind of jump to like how you feel, and I guess how like other residents and physicians and staff feel, like how do you cope with constantly being exposed to complex patients on a day-to-day basis? Because I feel like, you know, personally speaking, being just going through like I haven't been through internal medicine myself, but just being on the gen surg service, like there were times where we had discussions around MAID, we had discussions around end of life care. And at that point, I don't believe we had a medicine doctor with us, or maybe the medicine doctor did have some discussion with it prior to us going and talking to the patient. But I find that just having just a few interactions or just a couple interactions during my rotation was very mentally, like, it was a lot for me. And I feel like just going through that on a day-to-day basis, especially even, you know, being in internal med where you're exposed to this possibly more often than other specialties, like how do you cope with that? Do you have any strategies that you use yourself, or how do you kind of come home and kind of sit with that in a sense?
Yeah, no, for sure. Great question. Yeah, I think the complexity of the patients is one of the beautiful things of internal medicine, but it's also one of the very challenging things. And like you said, it can be very, very wearing having to deal with very complex patients day in and day out. I guess for my approach, it's just taking each patient like one at a time, taking the day as it comes. Whenever I start my day, I usually look over the patients that I'm going to be seeing, and I kind of make a priority list of like who needs to be seen first. Are there any like little tasks that need to be done for each patient, like first thing in the morning that need to be get done out of the way? And then whenever I'm focusing on each patient, I really just focus on that one. And obviously, if like other issues arise throughout the day, I can kind of shift gears. But it's really just taking each patient one at a time, giving the time that's needed for these patients, and to really like look over all their investigations, that sort of thing, and come up with a management plan for them. In terms of like dealing with like feeling overwhelmed and that sort of thing, I mean, I guess people have different coping mechanisms. I find if I'm getting overwhelmed throughout the day, I just take a second to like take a breath and like kind of reset myself and reorient myself to the day. But I think it's important to also have like a well-balanced lifestyle. I mean, if you come home and like you're just focused on medicine all night and then you go back in, like you're going to burn out, and it's you got to make sure that you have a bit of life outside of medicine too. So me, I like to come home, like I'll go for a bike ride or do something like active that like kind of helps me get the angst out from the day. And then like I'll put a record on or something and just listen to that while I'm at home to kind of relax, even if I'm going to get back into some medicine stuff later in the evening, just to kind of break up the day and make sure that I'm focusing on a bit of like my life outside of medicine too. I think it's really important to have that balance.
Right.
Thanks for touching on that. I think you, like in every field, it's important because residency is hard. Like it's hard in every field, some more than others. And I think internal medicine residency is, at least from what I've seen, especially on CTU, like very, very busy for the residents. And so, like you said, it's easy probably to reach burnout if you're not kind of taking the time to refresh or like recuperate from not the chaos of the day, but like the busyness of the days that you have. So I think that's really good that you still make the time to do those things despite being so busy. But thank you so much for, you know, talking about your experiences on internal medicine. I feel like you were able to really kind of paint a good picture of what this year was like for you and kind of the intricacies of the field that we don't get taught as medical students through our pre-clerkship years. And maybe even some things that we don't even see on our rotations on internal medicine. It's 5 weeks, which is a good chunk of time, but of course, not enough time to see like all of these aspects of the field. So thank you for doing that. And then just wanted to kind of switch gears, firstly, to congratulate you for being accepted into family medicine, which is amazing, and excited to kind of see your journey through that. And wanted to talk to you a little bit about kind of how your transition was and what your thought process was for transitioning into family medicine.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I want to preface all this by saying I think internal medicine is like great as a specialty. Like we talked about before, it's amazing being able to be involved in like the care of these super complex patients. It's super rewarding being able to like admit a patient, see them through their whole admission and discharge them home healthy again, and like being able to do the procedures and like everything else. It is a great specialty. I think that my decision to transition to family is like very based on like my own personal preferences and like my own personal goals and that sort of thing, and where I see myself in the future. I guess I'm an IMG, so I study medicine in Ireland. And our clerkship there is very observership based, so it's not very hands-on. And because I'm a COVID baby, we didn't have the opportunity to do electives back in Canada during that time. I did manage to do a like internal medicine-ish elective at a rural hospital with a hospitalist, with like a family medicine trained physician. But the patients were very not complex. It was very like very not a similar environment to how it has been in on CTU here at a more like a tertiary center. So I honestly didn't really have a lot of firsthand experience in internal medicine and CTU coming into this. I really did enjoy a lot of the subspecialties in my medical school training and that, and studying them and that sort of thing. And I was honestly really between family medicine and internal medicine whenever I was applying for residency. And I applied for both. I interviewed for both. And it wasn't until like about a week before submitting my rank list that I ended up switching internal medicine to higher than family medicine. And yeah, I was like I said, I was really between both of them. I think for me, I come from like a rural area. Like I grew up rurally. I see myself like living rurally after I finish residency and that. And I really do like that in family medicine, you can really go anywhere that you wanna to practice. With internal medicine, you can practice more rurally, of course, but you do need to kind of be near a hospital, and that sort of thing. So you are a little limited. Whereas I think family medicine, you can really go anywhere that you want. Over the past year, like there was a lot of things that I liked about internal, like I said, but I really didn't see any career path that I would have been super happy with in internal medicine. I didn't really have a light at the end of the tunnel. And whenever you're in a super intense residency like internal medicine, I think that you really do need to have that direction, or at least some idea of where you want to go and somewhere that you're going to be happy with. And I didn't feel that way. And I was like looking at a lot of my co-residents who love internal medicine and couldn't see themselves doing anything else, and they're super happy with what they're doing, and I just didn't feel that. And I think with any medical specialty, any residency that you're in, you do need to have a bit of that passion and feel that. I mean, this is what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, and any residency, any specialty is going to be super demanding. And if it's not something you're really passionate about and happy about, I think that it's going to be a struggle, and it's going to be an unhappy time for you. Yeah. So transitioning to family medicine, I think that I see myself happier in an outpatient setting, which is one thing that I want to do, or why I want to transfer to family medicine. Also, I just like the variety. I think that with family, you can really transition to your areas of interest. You can do things like ED, you can do addiction medicine, you can do hospitalists. So I think that I really like the freedom to kind of transition to different areas as my interests develop, or as the communities that I'm serving, as their needs develop, and that sort of thing. So that's something that draws me to family medicine for sure.
That's a really great perspective that you have, because I just finished my family medicine rotation in a rural area in Ottawa, in Barry's Bay. I'm not sure if you've been to Barry's Bay or not, but small community, and I was working at St. Francis Hospital, and like I would just see the family doctors that were there. So the family doctor that I ended up working with, he would pretty much do everything. So like we would run a clinic in the morning, and then we would do emerge in the night, and like the variety of patients that we see every night was just like different. Like I came into medical school wanting surgery, and I'm still thinking of really pursuing surgery. But then I did rural family medicine, and I'm like, huh, you get a little bit of the procedures, you get a little bit of medicine, you get that lifestyle, which is like super great. And I feel like you get a lot of like, because you're in a rural community, you kind of know a lot of people within the rural community too. So you might see familiar faces, they may recognize you. So I can definitely like see the attraction towards family medicine from what you're saying, and especially with like my short, I guess, 1 month in the rotation itself.
Yeah, it's an awesome specialty for sure. And I think the like the deep relationships you build with your patients too, like you follow them for their whole lives, which is really cool, a cool perspective as well.
Right. But yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Laviel Kiran, for joining us today and sharing experiences in internal and family medicine. It was incredibly valuable to hear about your journey. And that's the conclusion of our podcast today. So join us next time on MedMade Real.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.